From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Tuesday, November 8th, Election Day. It was a rainy day in Rochester, but that did not stop the crowds from going to see the gravesite of Susan B. Anthony. Early in the day, there were small gatherings, but as word got out, the traffic flow picked up, and by the dinner hour, the line to see Susan B. Anthony's grave was around 2 hours long. Thousands would leave stickers, flowers, mementos of some kind. It was a remarkable scene. Let's talk then about what happened last Saturday. The Women's March on Washington drew more than 500,000 people, and marches around the world drew millions. Is it safe to assume that Susan B. Anthony would have helped lead the marches if she were alive today? Well, it's a big year here in New York. New York State granted women the right to vote in 1917, 100 years ago, and the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House is working with local and state organizations to host events to mark that occasion. And on Wednesday, February 15th, the date of Susan B. Anthony's 197th birthday, the Museum and House will host an annual luncheon. And this hour, we've got a chance to hear from, well, someone who is scholarly and distinguished and is going to be here for that. We'll also let you know how you can get set to go on the 15th if you like. Deborah Hughes is the president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. She's here. Hello, Deborah.
Hi, Evan. Great to be here.
And great to have you. And on the phone with us is Ann Dexter Gordon, leading authority on Susan B. Anthony, editor of the papers of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and research professor in the Department of History at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. Professor Gordon, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Deborah, I want to just make sure we clear up right away here. You got a big event coming up on the 15th and people can still go?
They can still go. They can go to our website online, www.susanbanthonyhouse.org. Click on the link and register. Tickets are $75 for an individual, and we're still doing table sales right now.
You excited about having Ann?
Really excited. We have about 650 people who are registered so far, and we're still just about 3 weeks away. So people are excited about coming to hear Ann.
And, you know, when I go back and read the work, the writing that you've done over the years and other authorities on Susan B. Anthony, it seems like after her death, Susan B. Anthony will never be able to escape controversy in some ways. So there's always going to be this debate about what would she have done, what would she have said, what position would she have taken. To some degree, do you think we'll ever get past that?
Probably not, unless we ever arrived at some point of total sexual equality. Because I think that, and I can sort of guess what you might have read, that I think it's become so common to fight over her legacy, and it started very fast after her death. The suffrage movement itself in the early 20th century had factions, and they fought over Susan B. Anthony and which of them was the best heir to her values and her strategies and so forth. I think it's kind of sad, but I think it may be that it's inevitable. In the same way we still fight over the Civil War, we can't get that one settled in our lives. And I think when you have a controversial subject, this apparently happens.
Well, yeah, it was just a few days ago, Deborah Hughes and the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House had to sort of tweet a response to Saturday Night Live. And if you missed it, Kate McKinnon played Susan B. Anthony in a clip that in a sketch that, yeah, I thought it was pretty funny. It was Susan B. Anthony herself appearing during a modern day tour of the Museum and House and this group of women. And it turns out they kind of get annoyed by her. They kind of want to move on and go to dinner or go to New York City, and she's kind of bugging them. But then the way it ended caught some people off guard. Let's listen.
I fought so that women like you could speak your minds. I am proud of you.
Thank you, Susan. We have to go, but it was such an honor to meet you.
Yes. Bye.
And just remember, a woman is just as good as a man.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Also, abortion is murder. What?
All right, that's the end of the sketch. And if you are not a scholar of Susan B. Anthony, or you haven't sort of followed closely this debate about what position she would have taken, first of all, let me ask Deborah Hughes, and then we'll ask Ann, because I know the Museum and House wanted to tweet a little bit of a response just to clarify in case anybody was confused about how you feel the position is there. What did you think of that sketch?
Well, I had that sense that probably many a celebrity has when someone tweets and says, hey, you've been featured on Saturday Night Live, and thought, uh-oh.
did you know that was coming?
No, and okay. They did such a great job of a set that looks like the front parlor of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. It's pretty clear. They did some research, but no, we didn't see it coming, didn't have a clue about it. And then I was enjoying the skit. You know, it was kind of I liked the it was playing, but it was kind of critiquing the attention span of women. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you've got Susan B. Anthony in the room. Have a conversation with her. Then the last line was like, oh, you got to be kidding. One, some of the other things she says are pretty much close to quotes from her, and that's not something she ever said. And we've been trying to talk about the historical accuracy of representing her on that position for a number of years, and it kind of sets us back.
Well, let me ask Ann Dexter Gordon not only to respond to that, but, and I am sure you saw that Rochester's Carol Crossed, who's board president of the Susan B. Anthony Birthplace Museum, and Eric Anthony, an Anthony family descendant, they co-authored a piece for via the Washington Post, Post Everything, which is an online forum for the Washington Post. Under the heading that Susan B. Anthony would never even have attended the women's marches this past weekend. I'll read a brief part of that, and you can respond not only to that piece, but the SNL clip if you like. They write the following, quote, Anthony would never have joined a march in favor of abortion access. The unifying theme of Susan Brownell Anthony's life was to speak up for those without a voice. Anthony fought for temperance, the abolition of slavery, and especially the enfranchisement of women. She also spoke up for the voiceless child in utero, opposing restalism, the term that Anthony's newspaper and others at that time used for abortion. It's easy to chalk up Anthony's and other early feminists' opposition to abortion as a relic of their day and age, but these women were progressive and independent. They did not oppose abortion because they were conditioned to, but because they believed every human life has inherent and equal value, no matter their age, skin color, or sex. End quote. Now, Anne, you can respond to that, to the SNL sketch, and I will say, I know this subject has come up many times over the years. I'm only bringing it up now because you got SNL doing it. You've got this Women's March. You've got pieces written saying, you know, don't misunderstand Susan B. Anthony. What do you think?
Well, I don't think they've got the evidence. If they want to go oppose abortion, that's fine with me. But I don't understand this necessity to craft something that involves historical figures who don't leave us opinions about the subject. One of the things that confuses the evidence a lot is that for key years, 1868 to the spring of 1870, Susan managed a newspaper. It's a wonderful newspaper called The Revolution. It's about everything. People are writing short stories, poems, there's political news, there's all kinds of news. And at the time that she's doing that, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton was editing it, Susan was the manager, and there's a debate in New York State at that time about criminalizing abortions. And so in the spirit of their newspaper, they open it up to debate on that subject, on many other subjects too. They're debating federal amendments to the Constitution, and they're debating all kinds of things that are happening, divorce law, free love, you name it. They open up their pages. Lots of people write. It's not a newspaper with a staff and the kind of formal journalists that we might expect. And so you've got debates. You can pick out topics. You can pick out something that's said on almost everything from that newspaper. And one of the articles that they used to cite a lot actually was an article that went on to say criminalizing abortion wouldn't do any good at all. That isn't what the problem is. And yet they were claiming that because at some point it used the phrase child murder in this article, which wasn't by either Stanton or Anthony, because it used that phrase, it was useful for modern people who wanted to make their claim about, what's the moment of life, when does life begin? So that's the chief source of the evidence they've presented so far over the last 30 years, comes out of that newspaper. And I think it's a very complicated source because there is a real debate going on about law in a place and the newspaper's open for debate.
And so, Anne, would that be like if I, in 2017, ran a newspaper and one of the columnists who writes for this newspaper, but not me, a columnist writing for the paper that I own, wrote a column saying that it should be illegal to eat peanut butter. And 100 years from now, people said, look, Evan Dawson was opposed to eating peanut butter. You're saying that something that appears in a paper that they're running is not necessarily something that they would endorse. Is that correct?
I really like your example. I think it used to be that the arguments that the anti-abortion people have made in connection to Susan B. Anthony have evolved over the years, and they've gotten more sophisticated. Early on, they used to make exactly the opposite of what you just said. They used to make the claim that because she owned that newspaper, she must have approved it. I've seen that written out. But I think they've understood over the years of being questioned on it and of getting some better researchers working with them and so forth. They've gotten a subtler view of how that newspaper worked. And yes, that you don't get the 100 years from now, you should not be described as the anti-peanut butter man.
Okay, well, listeners, we're doing our best to defer to people with expertise, with scholarly expertise and years of study. But you can weigh in with questions or comments as you like as we go throughout the hour. I'll read one more listener email, and we'll try to kind of close the book on some of these subjects about what somebody did or didn't say or what their positions were. But here's one that, again, I think caught me a little off guard. It comes from a listener named Michelle. She said, Evan, you often have people asking for clarification on whether Susan B. Anthony supported or opposed abortion. My concern is on whether she was actually racist. I've read what she has written over the years, and I don't know why it's never been discussed on your show. Can you discuss it? So let me try to do that. And she sent me a link to a couple different articles that I had never read before. And I'll just read briefly, and again, I'll let Anne respond to what we do and don't know. So first of all, this the first one comes from Mike.com, M-I-C.com, and I'll read from their article. Quote, Anthony joined the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1856. Although she was an abolitionist and a one-time friend of Frederick Douglass, as the Root pointed out, she stood firmly against the passage of the 15th Amendment, which granted black men the right to vote after the Civil War's end. The amendment ended up splitting the women's suffrage movement and ended her alliance with Douglass, who believed the right to vote was truly a matter of life and death for black men, and as such, deserved priority over women's suffrage. Anthony heartily disagreed, and she once said, quote, I will cut off this right arm of mine before I will ever work or demand the ballot for the Negro and not the woman. End quote. And then they also point to a separate occasion, and again, I don't know that this is right, but I'll just defer to Anne here in a moment, where in 1872, Anthony was said to have said, quote, an oligarchy of wealth where the rich govern the poor, an oligarchy of learning where the educated govern the ignorant, or even an oligarchy of race where the Saxon rules the African might be endured. But this oligarchy of sex, which makes father, brothers, husbands, sons, the oligarchs over the mothers and sisters, the wife and daughters of every household, which ordains all men sovereigns, all women subjects, carries dissension, discord, and rebellion into every home of the nation. End quote. And what do you make of those links that this listener sent me? I mean, that's not anything I've sort of explored myself.
Okay, you have nothing but tough questions for me, I can see. the first one, couple of things, lots of things, but one that caught my eye in the first piece you read, or caught my ear, is this business about Douglass. There is no question that Douglass and Susan B. Anthony were at odds for a short period, 1868 maybe, certainly by 1869, and then they weren't. And that's an important factor here. Because in this feud as to whether all black people would get the right to vote or only black men would get the right to vote, and that's what this fight was about, was in that. But Douglass was a person who went, his loyalty to the women's movement was so strong that he went and argued with them in person, which most of the politicians of that era would not do. And the second the 15th Amendment was ratified, when he had accomplished what he thought was necessary for the safety of African Americans, he's back on the woman suffrage platform. And he, in fact, first takes it to the very people where the fight had happened. He goes to an American Anti-Slavery Society meeting and in 1870 and says, we need to take up woman suffrage now. And he gets a newspaper. I've forgotten exactly which year he leaves, moves out of Rochester and moves to Washington. But he has a new newspaper in Washington, and he starts using it to back up the claims that the woman suffragists, the white woman suffragists, and in Washington, D.C., there were African-American woman suffragists in the 1870s. And he starts using that newspaper to back up their claims. So it's And I think there's a one of the many problems is when you're looking for people understanding these things is when you're looking at a 50-year arc of somebody's career and American history, regardless of those people, is changing rapidly, it's very hard to say it unless you're very precise about time and place, what their position is. I don't like the language of the one you quoted from 1872, and I don't know that speech. I'd have to look around and figure out what one they're quoting. But what's happening there is that she's trying to make the point that the question of subservience and dominance between men and women is a very serious matter. That's the gist of that statement, and that it's affecting every one of us. So I don't like her language, but I don't read that as being an attack on the equality of African Americans.
Okay. Deborah Hughes, what do you think of that?
I think two things. Before the Civil War, we have Susan B. Anthony clearly critiquing our country as a place that has to do everything to eliminate injustices, slavery. She was, one of the most active speakers for the New York Anti-Slavery Society. And all of her statements leading into the Civil War are so clear about her position, as were her relationships and the people that she was working with. I think she's consistently all about universal suffrage, feeling that if you're going to have a democracy of the people, by the people, and for the people, everybody gets to participate, and not putting out dividing lines. And I think when we look at the after the Civil War, when the discussion's coming up about the 15th Amendment, it's what's offensive, one of the things that's offensive to her is it begins to divide the movement and the pie into particulars. And so the context isn't, I wouldn't give black men the vote. It's, I would give everyone the vote at the same time. And I think that's a different perspective. And, do you think it's fair to say she was very consistent in her universal suffrage stance?
Okay. And do you think so?
Yeah, I do think so. And I might bring up a local example for Rochester, which that I wrote about recently, that in 1903 and 1904, in the South, African-American men were losing the right to vote. It was like a rebellion against the Civil War solutions. And a man from Virginia starts touring in New York State to raise money to take a case to the Supreme Court questioning this change in constitution and law in the state of Virginia. It's an African-American lawyer who graduated from Howard University, and he's a pretty brave man, and he's lecturing all over New York State. And Anthony is helping him. She can't go to his meeting in Manhattan, but she sends a strong letter to be read at that meeting. She later gets in trouble with Southern racists ever having sent that letter. And then he comes up to Rochester for a fundraising meeting that's chaired by the mayor of the city. It has African-American ministers on the platform. It has white ministers on the platform. And Susan B. Anthony and this Mr. Hayes from Virginia, this African-American man, are the two speakers at that event. And so here's an 84-year-old woman who is out in public talking about the need for the vote to be restored to these southern states where it was being taken away. So I think it's hard to, who isn't a racist in a society that's as divided as we are? But if you look at action, I don't think she's anywhere near the bottom of the pile.
We're talking to Ann Dexter Gordon, leading authority on Susan B. Anthony, editor of the papers of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and research professor in the Department of History at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. And Ann is going to be here on February 15th. Deborah Hughes is with me in studio. She's the president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Big year. First of all, you always have your annual luncheon, a big event. You still have tickets available for that to come here, Anne, and to join that event on February 15th. People can get tickets where, Deborah?
On our website, www.susanbanthonyhouse.org.
And producer Megan Mack tells me that we're going to make sure that we have on the WXXI News webpage for Connections a link to the calendar that will help people see what's coming up throughout the year, because you're celebrating 100 years. You have a lot coming up?
We have a lot coming up. We already had a couple of wonderful events last week. In March, we're going to have a fun event we're calling The Raspberry. It's a project we're doing it with Artisan Works, kind of merging history and art together to entertain and inform. And our biggest project will be this summer's Votilla, where we will be leaving Seneca Falls on Monday morning after convention days on July 17th, and we're floating with 30 reenactors and 3 historic boats back to Rochester. And each stop along the way, we'll have presentations, a variety of exhibits, lectures, and reenactors.
Very good. So we'll make sure that you can find that calendar very easily. And let me ask both Deborah and Ann this question then. That larger question on what happened this past weekend and whether Susan B. Anthony would have been there. Deborah, do you have any doubt that Susan B. Anthony would have been at the marches?
I'd answer it a little bit differently, Evan. If you ask me what Susan B. Anthony herself would do, the answer has to always be, I don't know. She's not here. She's not with us. We can't
ask her. The humble answer is we can't always possibly say.
And that's the true answer, and that's the historically accurate answer. We didn't get the Washington Post to print our response to the
letter. You wrote a response.
We did indeed write a response, and what we said was Susan B. Anthony wouldn't be present, and yet Susan B. Anthony is present in many ways there. I actually saw lots of Susan B. Anthony T-shirts, some from some Rochester contingents that were wonderful. And in the sense that there were women who were speaking out, in the sense that there were women who had access to income that allowed them the way to get to Washington, D.C. or to any of the other marches, in the ways that men and women were feeling empowered and speaking out about it, the justice issues that were so important to Susan B. Anthony, then her legacy was very much present in all those places. And I think that would be true even in a room if we were to debate the issues about what Susan B. Anthony might have thought around reproductive freedom. For many of the women in the room on any side of the issue, Susan B. Anthony is very much present.
And do you have a best guess on what Susan B. Anthony might have done this past weekend?
I think Deborah's answer is the right one, that she wouldn't have been able to imagine our time, and there weren't big marches in her lifetime. I like Deborah's answer in another way too, which is that this notion, what she would have approved of, is the notion of women trying to figure out how to get their political voice heard. That's what her whole career was about, was trying to figure out how to get women's voice heard, whether it's through petitions, whether it's through testimony at congressional committees, whether it's by casting her ballot in 1872. Whatever it is, it's that notion that women have to take responsibility for the world they live in and have to find the tools and the vehicles for getting their ideas out and respected.
As you mentioned, there weren't large demonstrations of this scale in her time, but did she write or talk about the importance of, you know, voicing opposition in any sort of peaceful protesting way?
Well, she certainly, think of her casting her vote in 1872. That's a pretty brave act.
Indeed.
She goes to the polls and she argues with the local inspectors of elections and, you know, makes the case that the 14th Amendment gives her the power to vote. So they accept her ballot and it goes forward. And she actually did not expect to get arrested for that at all. And in fact, she didn't even expect, according to letters she wrote right afterwards, she didn't even expect to get her ballot in. The strategy nationally at the time was you went and tried to register or you tried to vote, and when you were refused, then you went to court to try to argue the case for women's rights through the court system. So she was caught off guard that her vote, that she succeeded in registering, succeeded in voting, and then has to go through the whole trial, federal criminal trial, over the next year. And I think it has another level that's a slightly different form of political action. When months after she's convicted, the inspectors of elections themselves are, some of them, thrown into jail because they won't pay their fines. They don't agree that they did anything wrong. And so Susan, there's these wonderful accounts of Susan and others of the women who voted are carrying fresh food into the jail for these men. They are bringing them better coffee than the jail serves. They are, and immediately in the, I think it's, Deborah will know for sure, the eighth ward, I think is the one that the house was then in, mm-hmm. that the men are in jail when the local voters re-elect them as inspectors of elections. So they were standing behind the men who accepted the ballot. And, I mean, there isn't a lot going on that's that direct right now.
Go ahead, Deborah.
We can take a lot of Susan B. Anthony's actual quotes and writings about different things. I'd love to quote one of the things that from 1857 when she was talking from her anti-slavery speeches, and this comes from her biography, and it also kind of addresses some of her understanding about race. She quotes Emerson, who said, "Good thoughts are no better than good dreams unless they be executed." And then she says, "So anti-slavery prayers, resolutions, and speeches avail nothing without action. Our mission is to deepen sympathy and convert it into right action, to show that the men and women of the North are slaveholders, those of the South, slave owners. The guilt rests on the North equally with the South. Therefore, our work is to rouse the sleeping consciences of the North." No one's ignorant now. "You recognize the facts which we present. We ask you to feel as if you yourselves were the slaves. The politician talks of slavery as he does of United States banks, tariff, or any other commercial question. We demand the abolition of slavery because the slave is a human being and because man should not hold property in his fellow man. The politician demands it because its existence produces poverty and discord in the nation and imposes taxes on free labor for its support since the government is dominated by Southern rule. We preach revolution. The politicians preach reform. We say, disobey every unjust law. The politicians say, obey them and meanwhile, labor constitutionally for repeal."
And that's from 1857?
1857.
And Deborah reading the words of Susan B. Anthony with a big smile on your face. I think an admiring smile. But let me also ask you, Deborah, then, before I get our only break, and then we're going to get some of your phone calls because the phone's ringing, and that's great. There are so many names, stories of women throughout history who have fought for equality, not just Susan B. Anthony, not just Stanton, not just Ida B. Wells. There's so many that we probably are undereducated as a society about. Having said that, with the work that you do at the museum and house, does it make you saddened to hear that some women of color don't feel that Susan B. Anthony is deserving of the status that she's achieved in this society?
My response to that would be, so would Susan B. Anthony would be much more interested in us talking about the racism today and how we deal with that as our society than spending time thinking about what Susan B. Anthony did or said a century and a half ago. And I think that that's true. She would have said, don't be distracted by arguing about historically. Obviously, racism is a horrendous problem in our country today, and it's producing all kinds of outcomes that are awful. How are we going to deal with that?
Yeah, those words that you just read, very, very powerful. And let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back to your phone calls. I want to ask both of our guests just what they thought of that scene on Election Day. I haven't had a chance to ask Deborah Hughes what she thought of the streams of people waiting hours just to leave a sticker on the gravesite of Susan B. Anthony. Really remarkable. We'll ask Ann Dexter Gordon what she thinks of that as well. And get your phone calls. Were you someone who waited in line on Election Day? Did you do that? Did you go to Susan B. Anthony's grave? Did you march this past weekend? What are your thoughts on some of these issues and related issues? You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. It's our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Reverend Myra Brown, who on Saturday will become only the third African-American woman priest in a Catholic church in this country. Now, the answer is no. The Roman Catholic Church has not changed the rules on ordaining women, but Spiritus Christi broke off from Rome in 1998, and we'll talk about this historic event with Reverend Brown next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get to the phone. Sam in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, Evan. I know you would know this, but I got to ask this to your guest. I'm a little confused about the march on Washington this weekend because there was 33% of the Democrats that did not vote. And I'm positive that some of the ladies who did not vote for Hillary was at that rally. And I'm sure some of them that voted for Hillary was at that rally. And I was just wondering, how is it that they could be so bamboozled about what the Republicans had put out about Hillary and not have any facts to go with it? When you spend $7 million on the thing that happened overseas there and come up with no evidence and no proof of it, how is it that the ladies would buy into that and vote against a historical thing such as, you know, the first woman president coming into office and really solidifying what the lady you were just talking, I can't think of her name, you were just talking about, solidify her stand, Susan B. Anthony there, and what she stood for. That would have been a great honor to Susan B. Anthony for all women, I don't care what ethnic group, to come together and say, let's do this together for Susan B. Anthony. And I'll listen to your response off the air.
All right, Sam, thank you. And Dexter Gordon, first up, what do you think?
Oh, thanks. I think it's a tricky one, and I see people throwing around percentages about what percentage of the white women voted for Donald Trump, and then that raises questions about where were the rest of the white women, and did they split their vote and divide it up or whatever. I don't understand how we know how a secret ballot works well enough to manage that part of the question of who voted for whom. I have been thinking, though, about the way in which Susan herself, and I'm sorry I keep doing that without calling her by her first name, but I've lived with her for so many years, it just happened, I think how she would argue against anything that suggested if women use the vote so badly, what, you know, why would they have it, that which is implied. I know the gentleman who called did not say that, but it's sort of implied in somebody saying that either people are not making the full connection. But because Susan actually has to fight people in her own lifetime on this point, there's a very big 19th century trend, not only in the United States, but in France as well, that women are more religious than men. And if you give women the vote, then we'll have a religious society that they're going to vote differently from men because they're more strongly engaged with their faith. And just as one example of the way in which this argument would play out in the 19th century, and Anthony always said, my interest is not in how you're going to use the vote, but the fact that you have an abstract right, regardless, to have the vote. And that is, she's absolutely committed to that. Now, she might question possibly if we transport her via Kate McKinnon into the modern age, she might, you know, not like the way a vote came out, but she would never doubt that women had the right to use it in the way they did. And I don't know how to think about the bigger question that the man is raising. Maybe Deborah has thought this through better than I have.
Well, an angle that I do come at this from is Susan B. Anthony was pretty clear that she wouldn't align herself with a political party because she felt that once you aligned yourself with a party, you aligned yourself on a number of issues. She was much more concerned about the social outcomes and using those as the measures rather than having to compromise. And so I think that as we approached the election in 2016, to follow Susan B. Anthony's model of what are the issues that are important, how do these candidates respond to that issue? I don't think she would have cared what party supported something. If she would have looked at the Affordable Care Act and say, are we getting the healthy outcomes that we wanted to get from that? Then we support it, then we get along with it. And I think that's one of the places she disappointed some of the people in her time, where she wouldn't commit to a party line. She really did think we should be educated and we should be voters who are looking at issues and looking at the positive outcomes.
Okay, that puts her in league with George Washington, sensing the dangers of partisanship. But we never listen. Most of us don't listen, it seems. David in Rochester, next up on the phones. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I did march this Saturday, incidentally. A question I have, and it's to get further informed. Where was Susan B. Anthony tried? I spent a lot of time in Canandaigua on the courthouse as an advocate for people. And apparently, from what I heard, she was tried in that courthouse. And I'm astonished, if that's indeed true, that there's no signage or no mention of that at all. Maybe you can give me some clarity on that, and I'll take the answer off here. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, David. Deborah Hughes, do you know the answer to that off
She was tried in Canandaigua. I believe the building is different. There is both a portrait of Susan B. Anthony, and there is a brass plaque in one of the chambers. And I don't know, Anne, you could fill in some more of the details about that, but they're pretty proud of that history. But I think it's possible that if you're not in the right room, you don't see it.
Okay. Anne?
Oh, and I didn't know about the inside because I only went there for the first time a couple years ago, and I went on a Sunday on my way to something else, and I couldn't get in the building. I think the building has been changed, but I haven't found anybody who can explain to me is there a part of it that's still, when you're outside looking at it, is a part of this still the original? And the reason that she's tried in Canandaigua, well, there's multiple, there's rival explanations as to why she's tried in Canandaigua. She's called to trial in Monroe County in May, and three things happen. One is that the Supreme Court had just made a new ruling that was going to affect how they handled Susan's case. So they really needed, the prosecutors needed a little more time. That's one of the explanations. Another is that Susan B. Anthony and a friend had been out speaking in every town of Monroe County to potential jurors to explain to them what were the issues at stake in this trial. And so one of the more popular explanations for the move to Canandaigua is that they needed a new jury pool that hadn't yet been taught by Susan B. Anthony. And then the third reason is that in Canandaigua, in those days, the term circuit court had a very literal meaning because Supreme Court justices rode circuit and presided over trials in their districts. And at Canandaigua in June of 1873, a Supreme Court justice was going to be presiding. And so by moving the trial, they also gave it this kind of, as one of the Rochester newspapers put it, this added weight of having an opinion come from a justice of the Supreme, associate justice of the Supreme Court. So it's transported up to Canandaigua. But of course she has time. It's a month later, so she has time to speak to the jurors of that county too.
David, thanks for the phone call and a nudge toward an interesting bit of history that many of us might not have been aware of. Let me get back to Geneseo. This is Jillian next up on the phone. Go ahead, Jillian.
Hi. You asked for feedback on people who went to marches, so I wanted to just put my two cents in. I went with my daughter and my granddaughter, who was 13, and my grandson, who was 11, and their friend Anna Lee to the Seneca Falls march. Oh. And we had a beautiful day, and it was wonderful, and it was very informative and all of that, and I had never done anything like that before, so I'm a brand new activist as a result of this election. But I was struck at how white this event was, and although I don't think I was all that surprised, but it's been nagging at me ever since how we can come together with people of color and have them trust us enough to be a part of what we are doing and how we can be more a part of what they are doing.
Hmm. Wow.
You're here.
Yeah. Anne, you want to add a little bit more there? Go ahead.
No, I am very glad. I mean, congratulations for going. I saw pictures of the Seneca Falls event afterwards, which were lovely. I went to Trenton, New Jersey. I didn't go to Washington. And I had a little bit of the same reaction, and there's even less excuse. Now, Seneca Falls does not have a lot, does not have a highly diverse population, so you might use that as an excuse. In central New Jersey, you cannot use that excuse. The speakers was a wonderfully mixed group, and heavily African-American speakers, Latino speakers. We had whole presentations in Spanish. What I was most impressed with, which might not have been evident in Seneca Falls, was that the Muslim immigrant community of New Jersey, which is very large, I assume that who was coming to the march would have been this, not the ones who were immigrated, but the children born here, they was very prominent in this. They felt safe enough to come to this event in Trenton, and I was very moved by that. And some of our speakers were from immigrant groups, organizations that help with immigrants, and religious leaders and so forth. So, but I was a little, I felt like I was in a bit of a too white an audience, and I know that given who was speaking, this was not a plan that the audience would be that white. But I think she's right that there's a problem here.
And I don't think that we can leave it to just getting the word out publicly, like on the media. We have to make a point of reaching out to black organizations, black churches, et cetera. We have to make it them feel safe with us. And I think so.
So I'm a little uncomfortable because I know that the audience for WXXI is very diverse. So this room right now is full of a diversity of people in the conversation. So I'm a little uncomfortable with the we, they language because I don't think that reflects the reality of who is participating in this conversation as they're listening on the radio today.
You mean the public conversation sort of that's ongoing, Deborah?
Yeah, the conversation we're having right now, mm-hmm. kind of talking about we need to do and they need to do. I'm uncomfortable that we've drawn that.
Well, Jillian, what do you think about that?
That's a good point. It's a very good point. I don't know enough how to put it a different way, but I would love to be able to put it a different way.
Yeah, okay. Well, Jillian, first of all, thanks for the phone call. I mean, a lot of tough stuff and important stuff to think about. I mean, I will say on Monday when we talked to people who went to various marches, the Washington March, the Women's March on Washington, and the Rochester event, we had a couple of phone calls from women who described themselves as older white women who said that, you know, that they are listening to women of color, and they say, yeah, for years maybe they weren't really in tune with it, and that they have to own that, but they are awake and consider themselves allies from this day forward. But the question is, what does that mean? And Tara and Victor wants to weigh in on what she's sort of seen since the marches. Go ahead, Tara.
Hi, Mr. Dawson. It's nice talking to you again.
Oh, so Mr. Dawson is my dad, but go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Mr. Dawson is my dad. You can call me Evan.
Oh, all right. Well, okay. Sorry. Well, I was at the event on election day at the gravesite. However, I was not at any of the marches this past weekend. But I have noticed, you know, a lot of people who've gone to those marches have taken that energy and that momentum home with. There have been an explosion of events in a lot of other cities that I've seen to keep that momentum going and keep activism going. And that's not something that I have really seen a lot of in the Rochester and Finger Lakes area. I'm not sure if I'm just not connected with those organizations or if maybe it's because we live in a blue state, so they don't feel the need to be as locally active. But I was wondering if you know of any of those kinds of events that I've seen so much in other states, but I've not seen locally here that are kind of a continuation of that effort.
Yeah, you want to see, in your view, you want to see what started on Saturday continue and not just be a one-off.
Exactly, and that's something that I've seen that kind of language a lot in other states, you know, in Tennessee or in Philadelphia or in Minneapolis. You know, I've seen people, they saw that day as just a starting point, and they've been as active ever since. There's been just a really robust activity.
Yeah.
With more events since then, and it didn't just kind of drop off like that. So I'm kind of wondering where is that here?
Tara, thanks for the phone call. It's an interesting point, especially in the context of the fact that we're talking about Susan B. Anthony. And I want to clarify that the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, to my knowledge, Deborah Hughes, isn't endorsing any single political position or even necessarily, I don't know if you sort of stay out of the marches in general, but a lot of people want to weigh in, I think, because we're talking about Susan B. Anthony, who was someone who was a woman of action, who spent her whole life, involved in action, trying to get results. And what Tara is driving at here is, how do you make sure what happened on Saturday doesn't get lost? What's the Susan B. Anthony message going forward to make sure that there is involvement? Do you have the same concern to the extent that you are allowed to have these concerns? I don't know. I mean, it's sort of an interesting, I don't know if it's a question that you can answer, you know, whether it's in a personal or professional capacity.
But that's a question we're always struggling with, because mm-hmm. we need to be nonpartisan, and yet we're celebrating and sharing and inspiring people by one of the most political animals that we know from a prior century. And I think one thing that's different, if the marches were partisan, if it was a particular party that did it, then clearly that's a line we're not going to cross. Neither would Susan B. Anthony have done that.
Okay.
I think in terms of looking at the issues, that's absolutely what she was about. And in some cases, the issues, you know, we know how she felt about pay equity. We know what she felt about public education. We know what she felt about freedom of the press. We know what she felt about a free judiciary. We know what she felt about corruption in politics. If people go out to the Women's March and read the manifesto, the description of the issues that were put on the table, I think that what we're going to have to see is we have to advocate for particular issues. And then how will people get engaged and be involved in that?
Do you think that's happening? Do you think that's going to happen?
I hope that that's going to happen. I think, you know, I did go to Washington to march, not representing the House, because we wanted to draw that line between—
Just representing yourself?
Between me, just representing myself.
Okay.
To me, it was a lot like being at Mount Hope Cemetery on Election Day. The mood was so positive and tender. People were so incredibly gentle with one another. Some of the signs were anything but gentle or tender. Some of the chants were pretty clear and a bit biting. But to be with 500,000 people who were doing so much to be with one another and to support and to listen, knowing that there was tremendous diversity. And I did see a lot more diversity in Washington than we saw in some of the other places in the press. And it was intentionally planned by women of color. And I think that was an important move.
Well, Anne, it turns out I could have just taken phone calls for about 2 or 3 hours with the way the phone's ringing, and I apologize. I just can't get through them all. Let me just ask you to follow Tara's phone call with just your thoughts. I mean, I know you're not here in Rochester now, but her concern is, as a woman who's concerned about these issues, that we don't see movements become one-day marches as opposed to consistent activism. What is a Susan B. Anthony message or lesson in what activism is?
Well, you'll have to come hear me speak on Wednesday the 15th.
That was such a softball. I teed that up for you.
That actually is what I'm going to talk about, one of the main things I'm going to talk about. But I think that I see people really trying to do what your caller wants done. And we have social media to try to see if that helps, something that Susan B. Anthony never had available to her. We don't know yet whether people can pull it off, and whether we can keep a focus on whether we can juggle as many balls as there are in the air at this moment. Can we solve the problem of a diverse group of people collaborating on these issues? I think that it took her a lifetime to turn herself into a top-notch organizer, and we don't have anybody with that organizing skill at the moment, and that's going to be part of the problem. We have better tools than she had, but I'm not sure we have somebody who's fought it through and tried all these different methods of mobilizing people and getting people to follow through on, say, a petition, getting them to stick with it when they get a setback and move forward. I think we're watching something that has possibly historic precedence.
Go ahead, Deborah, because we're running out of time, and I want to make sure people understand if they want to come on February 15th, they can do that. Go ahead.
Absolutely. To hear more from Anne, we're really looking forward to that. I've got a quote from Susan B. Anthony from 1863. For anybody who wants to be engaged politically, she says, "Forget conventionalisms. Forget what the world will say, whether you are in your place or out of your place. Think your best thoughts, speak your best words, do your best works, looking only to suffering humanity, your own conscience, and God for approval."
And that's a Susan B. Anthony quote in her own words. February 15th, February 15th, the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House has their annual birthday luncheon. 197 years old Susan B. Anthony would be. And if you want to go, get online and get tickets where, Deborah Hughes?
www.susanbanthonyhouse.org, or you can call 279-7490 if you're not able to do that online.
The conversations continue that started now, decades and decades ago, with Susan B. Anthony. And thank you, Deborah Hughes, for being here. Always great to talk to you. And Dexter Gordon, our honor to have you, and we'll see you in Rochester in February.
Thank you very much.
All right, short break and more connections straight ahead.